What's in store for your business this week at Staples?
Doing business like a CEO while saving like a CFO.
Staples has all the supplies you need to run your business like a boss at prices that'll make your bookkeeper smile.
Now that is an achievement.
Everything from markers and pens to 2019 desk calendars.
And right now, a 12-pack of Sharpie markers and an 8-pack of Expo dry erase markers are only $4.99 each.
At Staples, where there's a whole lot in store. Ends 1/19/19 in store only.
The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we speak with the fabulous Rick Sloan on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we'll be speaking with one of my favorite cult directors, the one and only Rick Sloan, the creative genius behind such low-budget cult comedy classics as the Hobgoblin films and no less than 6 Vice Academy films. Rick has worked with such cult actresses as Elizabeth Keitan, Ginger Lynn Allen, Linnea Quigley, and Jane Hamill, and his films have been frequently shown in such cult standbys as USA Up All Night and Mystery Science Theater 3000. A man with a great sense of humor about himself and his work, Rick's commentaries are often even more entertaining than the films themselves. Join us as we speak to Rick Sloan right here on Third Eye Cinema. Tonight we have with us a man best known for his often cheesy, somewhat sleazy, and always highly entertaining low-budget comedies. This is the man who gave us such beloved staples of USA Up All Night and Mystery Science Theater 3000 as the Hobgoblin's films, and no less than 6 Vice Academy films, working with such popular cult actresses as the lovely Elizabeth Keitan, gorgeous porn queen Ginger Lynn Allen, scream queen Linnea Quigley, and the always entertaining Jane Hamill. This is a man with a welcome sense of humor about both himself and his work, whose commentaries are often even more entertaining than the films themselves. Please join me in welcoming one of my favorite cult film directors of the modern age, Mr. Rick Sloan. Rick, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, Gene. I'm really glad you guys can have me on the show.
How's the weather out there in sunny California?
I live in the heart of Hollywood. It is a beautiful day today.
Now, there's been one running theme to this show, and that's
to... Go on.
And that's to encourage creative people to tune out all the naysayers, stop worrying about traveling the prescribed path, and get out there and pursue your dreams and implement your own personal creative vision. And you're actually a good example of that. So tell us about your time in film school, where I understand you were actually insulted by instructors, put down by peers, and even forcibly ejected from one filmmaking class by the professor since, quote, you didn't have what it takes to become a filmmaker.
Ironically, when I contacted every one of those film school teachers to do a DVD interview as a bonus, not one wanted to go on camera to recall these events. Actually, naysayers, I don't know, unless my mind is just programmed differently, I just take any criticism as a personal challenge, and I look at who it's coming from.
Right.
And some of the best laughs I've ever gotten is I Google myself every week to read bad reviews. There's some really clever ones. My personal favorite is still, if lack of talent were a crime, Rick Sloan would be serving a life sentence. I love that one. I mean, I don't know who wrote it, but I thought it was really good. But yeah, my L.A. City college days, I originally wanted to be an animator, but CalArts rejected me 2 years in a row. And in hindsight, I don't think I would have really found fulfillment as an animator. I enjoy the control of being a director. So I went to L.A. City College, and you know, everybody else wanted to make these pretentious, boring art house films that might possibly win some tiny award at some show. no interest to me. I mean, I would go every week. The closest grindhouse theater to where I lived was the Pacific Theater in Hollywood Boulevard.
Right.
I think it's been closed for years. And because they were the furthest east of all the main Hollywood Boulevard theaters, like, you know, 10 blocks on the Chinese and the Egyptian,
right,
they would tend to get the movies, I don't know, from like 79 to 82. If these films weren't getting R ratings, I don't know if they had self-imposed X, they just didn't have a rating. But half the films they show were like Maniac, God, I Spit on Your Grave.
Typical grindhouse.
But I mean, really shocking graphic film. All these films that made the Video Nasty list.
Right.
And I was really heavily influenced by those. I mean, I enjoy, those are the types of films I wanted to make. I didn't want to win any film, you know, prize.
Right.
So no one in film school got what I was trying to do. And because I was making a different type of film, I was like a weekly joke for everybody. I mean, everyone else would show their pretentious thing and, you know, all of my favorite quotes. Like, we spent an entire day getting the shot, but it was worth it. You know, if you went to a film distributor's company and you wanted to get a movie financed and you used that sentence, they would physically have you removed.
That's true.
I mean, even Spielberg, I don't think it's a luxury of an entire day. I could do it a beautiful shot if I spent all day, but never mind. So, yeah, while I was there, did a couple fake trailers. I did the original Grindhouse trailers way before Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez did them. I had Chainsaw Chicks, Amputee Hookers, Nightmare of the Lost Horse, and the Clown Horse of Hollywood. I'm very proud of them. Clown Horse appears in Blood Theater as a preview, and I think Chainsaw Chicks and Amputee Hookers are in Hobgoblins 2 as a bonus. But so I was making these films, and nobody got me or what I was trying to do. And yeah, the directing teacher dropped me from his class, and he said, I really need to weed out people who don't belong in it and suggest I get a different career. And then I used a fake 10-page script while I was shooting a feature film, which nobody wanted to work on. I had a crew of like 3 or 4 people.
Right.
I'd never worked on a real film set. I just imagined that I could shoot a feature the way I shoot 3-minute films, and I was kind of right. And they didn't figure out it was a feature until it was ready in the can, and they weren't that thrilled. And the first time I screened it, everyone was telling me, cut it to 10 minutes, file bankruptcy, and I'm thinking, you people aren't my audience.
Right.
And someone else who spent $10,000 in a year making a 10-minute film was paid $300 from Showtime, and people clapped for 3 minutes straight. Congratulations. And I was 21 and still a student. I got a distribution deal on my first feature, and I got my foot in the door to negotiate my second feature. And it was interesting when that was announced in class, there was a minute of dead silence. Yeah, the very teacher who asked me to drop his class, I had to wait a year until someone else taught it. In less than a year, I was already guest lecturing in their auditorium for 300 students. And
wow.
I could just tell. It was a kind of, nothing's lost on me. I'm very self-aware. The combination of just everybody with their, I should have your job. I'm better at it than you, but damn it, you did it first. And I know you have. Okay. But it was just funny because all the questions were backhanded, and I was still laughing. So I, and that was the last time I set foot at LA City College until, like, last year. I went back with a camera crew trying to get some interviews. And then everyone was nice about it, but no, I don't want to go on camera. So I really wanted to, I just wanted to hear all their criticisms of my film and the fact I still did it. But yeah, it'll be funnier when I tell it from my side anyway.
I don't know if you've got a bad connection.
No, this is my 1964 Princess film I just restored.
Is this one any better?
Oh, that's much better. Yeah, you said you restored that 64 Princess film. Was that the same one Miss Devonshire was using in one of the Vice Academy films?
Oh, it's actually the one in Hobgoblins 2, it's a turquoise one, that Amy has in her bedroom.
Okay, because my wife, when I told her about the Princess film, she said that right away. She's like, didn't you use that one of the films?
Yeah, I'm obsessed with a whole generation, slightly before my own time, but I'm really into the late 50s, early 60s, you know, there's so much period stuff I throw into my movies, mostly because I get to keep all the props afterward, but
right.
I just replaced the whole guts of that telephone on with a different one from eBay, and that's what I get, never mind.
Rick, let me say that when I was in my late teens watching Gilbert Gottfried on Up All Night, I never pictured that 20 years or so down the road, I'd be speaking with the director of the Vice Academy films. The original Vice Academy was actually a big film for me. I'm sure those who knew me around that time can attest. I mean, I'd already become a big fan of Linnea from her roles in films like Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Ballerama, Night of the Demons, Silent Night, Deadly Night. But here she was paired with one of my two favorite ladies of porn, Ginger Lynn. So it was an instant hit, particularly because it's such a silly film. Now, I
isn't it hit? The two of them didn't get together too well.
I know. I heard that
on set, but just first lady, you know, I can't embarrass her with how low her paycheck was, but they both, I mean, it was the first one.
I actually enjoyed and still enjoy the Vice Academy series far more than
I love it. I call Jake. We're still in touch. She's like my pseudo mom. She's only 9 years older than me, but she's kind of like the fantasy Eve Arden mom I never had. I love Miss Devinger. Yeah, she was always my favorite character. I was so disappointed in the three when she wasn't able to do it.
Right. I actually enjoyed and still enjoy the Vice Academy series far more than the Police Academy series it was ostensibly derived from. And these days, much to my surprise, my wife's become an even bigger fan of this than I was. I'll tell you the story behind this. I was finally sitting down to watch the later films in the series on that Advantage Hot Cops and Good Girls set, which I can't recommend enough to Rick Sloan fans, as it contains all the Vice Academy films, plus Good Girls Don't. Rick's commentaries are priceless. But I was watching these by myself in the early morning, and I just assumed she'd hate these because, you know, from that period, she doesn't really like much. I was in the middle of, I'm going to guess it was Vice Academy 3, and she woke up and walked out, and to my astonishment, she sat down next to me, started watching, and in short order, she started laughing like crazy. So I took her back to the beginning. We watched all six films, and then we went back and watched them all again with the commentaries, which is really And, you know, you tell some really great stories from behind the scenes. One thing that the audience really needs to have to enjoy a Rick Sloan film is a good appreciation of camp, because particularly in terms of the Vice Academy films, these movies are extremely campy.
Well, some of the Hobgoblins, but everyone thinks Hobgoblins was unintentionally bad. It's a lot more intentional than people think. But, yeah, Vice Academy, for all the success Hobgoblins acquired in the last 10 years, Vice Academy was my biggest hit. I mean, it was obscene. That first one did really well. It's my big. It's yeah. It was amazing.
The fact that you did six of them says something.
Should have done five. It was kind of, you know, every TV series, every movie franchise is always one too many. One and three are fan favorites.
Yes.
I actually liked four and five. I know they're not the early part. I just thought the first one, I didn't have the format down. These films were made up until Vice. These films are made primarily for international distribution. So I had to go more for mimicking the look of, you know, like a crime thriller, but just a cheesy, like, low-budget one. And by the second one, they became much more sitcom-like, where there's a lot more interiors, and it's much more about the banter of the characters back and forth.
Right.
And Married with Children was the show I was really trying to just get their style down. And I just noticed the camaraderie, because the cast, with the exception of one actor per movie, everybody came back over and over for 9 years.
Right.
And I just felt they got better and better. I knew their timing. I knew how to write for their delivery. And I just really thought four and five, I know, not the two most successful of the series, but I was the fondest of them.
Well, four is the one where Miss Devinger gets married, right?
Yeah, four is the wedding one. Yeah,
that's a great one. That's actually my wife's favorite.
And five is the virtual reality hooker, which I thought was hysterical.
Getting back to seeing Vice Academy and Up All Night back in my teens, I understand that it was actually the highest rated late night film on cable when it first aired. I had no idea. So,
it was the highest, for USA Network, it was their highest rated late night movie. I never really understood ratings, but the typical USA Up All Night film, first airing, it would get like a 1.2, 1.3. Second airing, it would dip to like 0.9. Third, it would dip to 0.5. Right. And their contract would expire. They would not renew the movie. Vice Academy, over and over, would get, always broke to get a 2.2, 2.3, 2.1 on its second, third, fourth, eighth rerun. Because my films have always lent themselves to multiple viewing.
Yes.
And they just said, you know, we don't have any other movie that brings in these numbers. So, yeah, I did, you know, I kind of, you become a little creatively bankrupt making a few too many sequels, but I had fun with the Vice Academy films. You know, I kind of missed doing them.
So how early on did USA commission you to continue Vice Academy as a series? Because I understand they just kept asking for further entries after each film came out.
I wasn't even sure. I think it must have just been the title. Hobgoblins and Vice Academy, and the one I did the next year, March for Murder, were my three biggest hits. And Vice Academy, no one had even seen the movie yet. I mean, it wasn't finished. And Playboy Channel licensed it, even, you know, it's not an erotic movie.
Right.
On the premise, on the cast, they didn't even want to wait to look at it. They just grabbed that thing. So they got it. USA, I don't think they knew. I don't know. They liked it, and they licensed it. And when it broke all previous records, yeah, they would come back. Like every 18 months, they'd want another one, and I just kept churning them out. And it was all, as long as I could guarantee that, like, who the two leads would be. And they had a whole list of things. When you make sequels, they have to follow all the old rules set up in the early movie. And they have to look like, because they would always run them two and three in a row, that... Right. If you went to get something to drink and two ended and three started and you came back, that you wouldn't really notice. So there was a lot of work making, you know, the same location, just getting everything to pick up where we left off 2 years ago.
Right. But even back in the days when the original Vice Academy had aired, I had friends laughing and groaning when I pull out the VHS for the umpteenth time, you know, making fun of how bad or cheesy it was, the very things I liked so much about it. I mean, you also had a nice understanding or feel for the seedy side of Hollywood, particularly the porn industry of the day.
I went to Hollywood High School. I grew up in the neighborhood. That's just what Hollywood looked like. Yeah, I didn't have to seek that out. I remember just driving through the worst parts of the town trying to find a really seedy block where they walked to, from, just a place full of porn theaters. You know, I went to, like the North Valley, I went to the airport. And it was funny, for all that work, it was just, you know, a block from the Pantages Theater is where we found it. No, there's just one, there's a, Hollywood Boulevard is a pretty, like, Times Square looking area.
You don't see that often in film. It really doesn't get picked up unless you're watching, like, a porn film from the period, or maybe some heavy metal videos, because those guys were hanging in that culture, too.
No one shoots on Hollywood Boulevard. I mean,
exactly.
It's practically, I wouldn't call it Skid Row, but it's getting, you know.
You even had a nod to the whole Tracy Lord scandal, which was quite new at the time, like the Cherry Pop character.
So, I loved that one. For Vice Academy 3, the character Malathion, I wrote that for Tracy Lords.
Wow.
I really wanted to work with her, and Ginger absolutely refused. And if you watch the film, you never see both of their characters in the same shot. I mean, I used Julia Barton to play it, but I wrote it that I could literally have shot it without ever having the two of them do a scene together.
Well,
but so, Ginger just did not want to work. And Ginger was such a pain in the butt by that movie. You know, I should be in a movie. Doesn't matter. She was long gone by the next one. She oddly kept making these cameo appearances from Remaining Flesh. I think it's funny. Vice 3 was the last one she did, but, you know, she makes appearances in Fire. Those were my favorite ones, just coming up, just making fun of someone with leftover footage.
So the film was quite unusual in that it was mostly a goof, but it had some serious undertones that you didn't actually take seriously at all. So it was like a double joke.
The Cherry Pop thing? I actually never thought the joke was that obvious when I made the film, but yeah, everyone picked up on that one.
Yeah, I know it right away.
It was a slightly more serious film. I mean, it was the most difficult of the six. We had so many locations. I had this big thing because I don't like shooting exterior daylight,
right?
Because you're chasing the sun, and at the same time, you kind of need permits. Or at 2 a.m, you know, no one's going to come outside and ask to see your permit.
Right.
So, my films, I mean, we're notorious for, like, just shooting stuff without permits. So, I mean, literally, Visitants, Hobgoblins, Vice Academy, Mark for Murder had a lot of night stuff, but they were all plots where teenagers were on the run and had to solve a problem before the sun came up so we could shoot all the movies at night.
Wow.
I mean, Visitants, they had to stop those aliens from invading on Halloween night before dawn. Hobgoblins,
right.
Those puppets are attracted to light, and they must be stopped before dawn. Vice Cabby, they have to arrest everyone and make it a graduation, which randomly was 7 a.m. to make that plot point work. But...
I didn't even realize you had constructed them that way. That's great. So,
I don't like 6 a.m. call times. My favorite ones are noon till midnight. It's just, I don't know, like, you shoot all your daylight, you break, and you shoot your night scenes. And the beach film I did was the only one where we had 5:45 a.m. call times, and I hated that movie.
Right.
No, I didn't hate the movie. I hated shooting. It was so
shoot, right, yeah. So how did Vice Academy come about? Because the Police Academy influence is obvious, but it's very different from those films in most respects.
What's really funny is Vice Academy was never based on Police Academy.
Really?
Yeah. The title, I knew I had the word vice. The second word took me a while to come up with. The title is very derivative from Police Academy.
Right.
It's like Hobgoblins, believe it or not, is not really written as a ripoff of Gremlins. I wrote it earlier. based on, they just remade it, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark or the Fireplace Monsters. That's the film with the old man warning, giving those warnings. I originally had based the film on that, but there were no puppets in it. You never saw them. And it wasn't until Gremlins came out, the distributor said, you know, this other script you have, if you put some puppets in it. So, yeah, it was rewritten to resemble Gremlins, but the script was different. Now, Vice Academy, it was based on, if you ever watched Charlie's Angels, you have to see it before the syndication cuts the main credits. Once upon a time, there were three little girls who went to the police academy. And I just remember watching that in syndication and going, God, imagine this school, like, girls, today we're going to learn how to dress like whores. Today we're going to learn how to be strippers and go under just some school that would teach all that stuff.
Wow.
And I thought it was such a great concept for a movie. Though I didn't have the title. I knew I wanted the word vice. And yeah. Police Academy had just came out. And, yeah, I just – those two magical words. I'm always proud of my titles, Vice Academy, yeah. So, yeah, the title was very Police Academy influenced. I knew what Police Academy was. I actually had not gone to see it. The films, I mean, they're structured like episodes of Charlie's Angels much more than Police Academy. Oh, and Batman, which I loved as a child because the villains were so ridiculously over the top and stuff.
That would explain why I like them, because I don't really like the Police Academy films, but I love the Vice Academy films. So how did you wind up with so many actual porn stars in your film? Because there's not only Ginger, but Viper, who appears as the director of the Zero Budget Porn Flick that Lynae becomes a willing part of.
That was when she actually submitted her photo. She had a different name, and I actually didn't know who she was. Someone else pointed it out. But it was funny because she had two phone numbers, and she did Stephanie Bishop. I don't know if she did any other mainstream movies, but it was just funny. You call that number, and it's like, Stephanie can't come to the telephone right now. Please leave a message. And then her other number, she was married to Bill Margold, which is, I don't exactly his title, but I mean, he's a freedom fighter for porn. The other phone number was, Viper and Sweet Willie can't take your car. She just read the part really. Jane Hamill and her actually read for both characters, and it was really hard for me to decide. Jane did a really good impression of someone who was, like, stoned and had trouble walking in platforms,
right.
And I almost cast her as that age. But Viper just liked that role better, and I think it worked out better in the long run. But, yeah, Julia Parton is Nina Alexander in porn. Tony Alessandrini is Tony Alexander. You need name actors when you work low budget, and basically the only people you can get is someone who had a fall from grace, usually from a few too many DUIs, who's not bankable. Should I name? Well, I have a running joke right now of how soon till I can afford Lindsay Lohan. to me, it's down to like less than a year already. Yeah, perfect she'd be for one of my movies.
It would be great. Vice Academy 7.
Oh, there's a script for that. I completely forgot where we were going on Vice Academy. I was just jumping around. What was the last one?
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Rick Sloan. Coming up, we discuss Ginger Lynn, humiliating the cast, Vice Academy 2 and 3, swapping Lynae Quigley with Liz Caitan, and the fake Miss Devonshire, only here on Third Eye Cinema. Behind having Ginger keep her clothes on throughout the series, frustrating viewer expectations.
I was amazed anybody got that joke.
You know, basically, you're frustrating viewer expectations just for the sake of having a laugh on her.
There's 100 movies where Ginger takes her clothes off.
Yes, I've seen about half of them.
Oh, yeah, I rented 6 in one day after we stopped working together just to laugh. Because she was always talking about in interviews how porno, she had given it up for 3 years when she was doing Vice Academy. And when we were shooting part 2, She was doing an interview that she hasn't done porn in 5 years, and assistant cameraman came up to me. He goes, I just shot a porn with Ginger over this past weekend, and she said, everybody, this was made 5 years ago. And I remember she's wearing the same dress in Vice Academy 2 in it with the same hair. It was really funny. I don't know. I just, Ginger was the first one. I didn't seek her out. I mean, she read for it, and she was the only one who got the character. I mean, her haughtiness, I don't know, her disdain. The idea that she was the upper crust one, even though she was a porn star. And there's something funny, just a line of dialogue that wouldn't get the same joke from another actress would get a different joke. Just the way she'd say it, like, this is the most disgusting thing I've ever done on duty. But so much was unintended. And she'd always bring her own wardrobe, which was obviously from porn. It was ridiculous. Like, she's in the classroom wearing this, like, see-through negligee. And they're, did you bring anything else, Ginger? No? And they're, all right. I know the graduation scene in the first movie where her gown gets torn off. I mean, we were shooting in a public park at, like, 2 in the afternoon. And kids had just gotten out of school, and I had no idea what she had underneath it. I mean, I said just white underwear. I didn't say, like, you know, a thong with, like, in a see-through. I mean, it was just, I mean, oh, my God. God, the park ranger must ran like 200 yards and said, do not shoot that. We already got the take. But. So even telling Ginger to keep her clothes on, oh, and in part two, her assless chaps, she brought those from home. So telling her to keep her clothes on, it, you know, you still see plenty. But I was just trying to make Married with Children. I wasn't aiming, I wasn't trying to make softcore porn. I like that the comedy value of Married with Children where it's more degrading, but it's still sexual and funny.
Right. Speaking of Linnea Quigley, how did you get her for the project? She seemed to be ubiquitous at the time. There weren't many cult horror films or horror comedies that she wasn't part of.
God, I think it was at the same party where I met Ken Hall, who did the Hobgoblin puppets. And I knew she was an actress, but I couldn't pinpoint her name. And Ken Hall may have actually directed me towards both Ginger and Linnea. And I spoke there at the party, and she just had the right look because I had the script, but I hadn't even started casting yet. And I just told her it wasn't a horror movie. I mean, it's much more of a comedy. And she said she was interested in reading it. And yeah, she read it and called me and said, sure.
So tell the listeners what happened with Ginger and Linnea, because I understand from your commentaries and what you had mentioned before a little bit is that they got on like cats and dogs or oil and water.
I don't know what it was. Linnea's not the feuding kind. A lot of it was it just Karen Russell got along well with Linnea, and Ginger just kind of felt, you know, Karen was the most abrasive of the three. And there was just a tension on set. I mean, the actresses just didn't like each other. They were very competitive. I mean, God knows, if whenever it was time to shoot stills, I could never shoot one more still of one actress if I had to get an equal number because I hear complaining. It was a lot of competitiveness. And during the cat fight scene, they are beating the hell out of each other. Or more like Ginger's beating the hell out of Linnea. But yeah, those two did not get along. They seemed to get along. Without Karen, they got along better on part two. But Ginger and Liz Caton was like the only actress that got along with Ginger. I mean, they loved working together. I love Liz Caton. She was, like, so easy to work with. She was such a pleasure.
So you once commented that one of the biggest, quote, problems with Vice Academy was that the girls were supposed to look innocent when they weren't working undercover, which is pretty much impossible when the leads are Linnea and Ginger. Both of them were,
I know. The only time I ever pulled that off, it's in Hobgoblins where you see the prim Amy at the beginning of the movie and then the shock of what she looks like all tramped out. It's just because she was not a porn star. I mean, it's like that movie poster for Angel, like schoolgirl by day, hooker by night. I just that extreme contrast. And I don't know, Ginger and Linnea, I mean, no matter, maybe they didn't bring their own clothes. I mean, Karen Russell was even harder, but they never looked innocent. So I think one of my favorite jokes, I don't know if it was in the script before, I just threw it in to make use of it. It's when they're in class learning how to apply horror makeup,
right.
And she calls Karen and Linnea to the front, and Ginger goes, "Would it be more beneficial if you tried it on girls who were so cheap looking to begin with?" But yeah, the way they look in class and the way they look undercover as hookers, it's pretty much the same. Yeah, I was never able to get the contrast I was hoping for.
Well, it actually adds to the absurdism of the setup, so it worked well, you know, as it unto itself.
That line's a good example of their reactions, the way Ginger says it. That line's literally what they were all thinking. That's probably exactly what Ginger would have said on her own, exactly the dirty look they would have given her back.
I understand that you shop for costumes at the Salvation Army store and racked up such exorbitant costs as 50 cents and a dollar for the ensembles we see on screen. And I also believe you kept that tradition up for each successive sequel. Was this for a joke? I mean, did your cast know about this? And did they appreciate all the wonderful outfits you came up with them to wear?
Well, none were 50 cents, but I would say easily a third to half the costumes of my films. I would just go right for the $1 rack. Usually it was a Goodwill. But because ironically, the stuff that would wind up on the rack was the most garishly colored and whorish stuff.
Right.
But I never felt I succeeded. To me, I think Blood Theater is the only one. I was one of the actors so mortified by the way they looked in costume and makeup that they would not wander off the set. They would not, like, you know, go to Taco Bell for, like, a quick snack or something like that. And no matter how cheap these costumes were, actresses always wanted them after the movie, and they're, God damn it, you're supposed to be embarrassed wearing it and not want to add it to your wardrobe.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask. It's like, you know, did they appreciate these wonderful outfits? You know, did you keep trying to top yourself just to see how much indignity they'd be willing to bear?
I gave up trying on that one because, I don't know, it was one of those things, just what I want, the effect I wanted never came off because, you know, the clothes fit the movie.
Right.
I mean, not every costume was a dollar, but, I mean, you know, just whatever I couldn't find for a dollar, I'd have to, like, on. Like, Good Girls Don't, nothing was a dollar. I mean, we spent good money on that movie. No, it just worked out really well. I mean, you know, we weren't going for high-end. Well, Ginger would bring her own stuff sometimes. But I wasn't going for high-end clothing. I wanted cheap slut outfits and, you know. The stuff that, I don't know, the stuff that seedy hookers would wear. And, I mean, they're not going to designer stores.
So, getting back to the films themselves. I have to say, I also got a big kick out of Vice Academy, too. The whole big nightstick trying to seduce all the girls and Spanish fly spiking the water at this police station cooler. It was so stupid and low rent like a cartoon. I absolutely loved it. So, Linnea the
Pony. That was one of my favorite lines. I was trying to think what's the most degrading way he could talk about a woman. Like, yeah, I passed around the room to all my friends like a dirty magazine. And then she walks up. Hi, Petrolito. Oh, we were just talking about you. Just every movie I try to come up with, that's the one I really raise the bar in, some of the most humiliating dialogue. Like in Vice 2, when they're going for the interview to be accountants, they don't know, they think they're going to be strippers. So he goes, what makes you think you're qualified for the job? And Ginger's there, well, my morals are low and so is my IQ. Or my all-time favorite is in Vice 5 when the councilwoman shows up and she goes, is there any sexual harassment going on here? Like, the girls don't know what you know, like a coworker trying to peer down your blouse or copping a feel. But, I mean, this whole idea of this being so feminist about things that shouldn't be on the job. So say that happened here, and, like, the two of them are having a silent orgasm. Oh, like, I wish. That's a dream job. This whole world where things that would not be appreciated in the real world are just so heavily valued. And then even Ms. Devonshire is there. So, any sex offenders who may need some work release? No, just all the characters are either, like, overly sexed or overly sexed but repressed about it.
So, Linnea departed after Vice Academy 2 and we were replaced by another of my cult film favorites, Elizabeth. I knew her as Elizabeth Kaitan, but you said Kate.
Kate.
Of films like Assault of the Killer Bimbos, The Girl I Want, Rollerblade Warriors Taken by Force. And like Linnea, she had a slasher under her belt, Friday the 13th, Part 7. That actually, she had two. She was also in a Silent Night, Deadly Night film, the amusing and infamous Part 2, where half the film was recycled footage from the first one. Liz had a very different vibe from Linnea. She was playing more of the dumb blonde thing, but she had a very sweet sensibility about her. You just wanted to give her a big hug or something. So tell us about how you got together with her.
Liz had read for me originally for Hobgoblins, but she wasn't right. I was reading primarily for the girl who played Pixie with a 3-foot beehive.
Right.
And I don't know, she wasn't right for that part, but I remembered her. And Linnea, I know in Assault of the Killer Bimbos, Linnea was supposed to be the star. When they gave it a bigger budget, they replaced her with Liz Caden. So I think one other movie did that also. And Vice Academy 2 is the only one I did knowing there would be another sequel. All the other ones, I was not planning for the next one. I thought this will be the last one. Because, right. One, it was a joke, that title card, the class most likely to get a sequel. I did not really plan that. But two, the movie doesn't end. It just stops with a lot of loose ends. Because I just figured I sent Ginger off to jail because I figured, you know, she'll be the one who's not going to want to come back for a third one. And Linnea gets promoted, and I figured, perfect. And Linnea had this new agent who, oh, my God. I mean, considering, I mean, I just did a movie with Martin Sheen and Wings Hauser. And Linnea's new agent read the script and calls me up. And I do this line a lot in interviews. She goes, I just read this script, and I think it is far below Linnea's abilities. And I'm thinking, is that possible? I was more bothered by the fact that Linnea had agreed she would do the movie, and I had her name attached to it, and we offered her, she would have gotten a pretty good paycheck for free. And you know, her agent, I hated the fact that she always made me negotiate with her agent. She regretted it because she called me the day before shooting and said, is there any way I could do your movie? I said, well, yeah, if you hadn't used her agent to turn me down. And I actually had to call Linnea to get Liz Caden's phone number, but... And oddly, of all the Vice Academy actresses, by a mile, Liz gets the most fan mail.
Yeah, I can understand that.
I actually thought it was embarrassing because I was really afraid, because USA Network loved Linnea, of, gee, what's going to happen? USA Network, we don't have Linnea. Prism Entertainment, we didn't get Linnea. Foreign, we didn't get Linnea. Everyone thought the movie was better without her. I thought it was really hilarious. She didn't work for years after that. But, Liz just replaced her, and I did the Charlie's Angels joke. Oh, I'm her younger sister, which I did much better in 5 when I wanted to humiliate Ginger. I cast Ray Lynn because she looked like Tracy Lords. And named the character Tracy. And the commissioner goes, I expected much more out of you being Holly's younger sister. You mean her much younger and much prettier sister?
Another interesting thing about Part 3 is how it's the only entry with, as my wife puts it, the fake Miss Devonshire. So tell the listeners what happened here, since it was the only one of 6 films not to feature Jane Hamill in the role.
That was a tough one because the original actress playing Samantha, Linnea, and Jane Hamill, like a week before shooting, all dropped out. And the movie almost got canceled.
Yeah.
She works as a television writer, and she was offered the Jenny Jones show, but it was, I think, Chicago. I mean, it was a major conflict. And I was willing to pay to fly her out on 2 weekends just to get it, and it just wasn't possible. I tried.
Right.
And oddly, if you've seen my Beach movie, right?
Yes. Yes.
That woman could have played Miss Devonshire. I mean, she had her day on.
Yes.
The one at the bikini contest. Oh, disqualified. That's small on your bikini wax. No, I used Jordana from Visitants. She's a funny Miss Devonshire, but it's like a foreign spy is playing her.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I actually thought she did a fair job. She certainly looked the part, but she didn't have the same touch as, you know, the comedic feel of uptight, puritanical right-wing America, you know, totally neurotic because they're afraid to act on their impulses and they're busy trying to regulate behavior and everyone else. Jane really nailed that role, so it was almost impossible to substitute her with anyone else.
Well, she just didn't play it from the same standpoint. Yeah, Jane was much more, I never watched Our Miss Brooks, but it's heavily based on Eve Arden's principal character in Grease, or as I like to say, Mary Warnoff's take of that in Rock and Roll High School. Because I wrote Miss Devonshire with Mary Warnoff in mind, but I couldn't afford Mary in every movie. I've only used her twice. I love Mary Warnoff.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Jordana just played the roles almost like a little too savvy and not as humiliated and taken advantage of.
Yes.
But she sure gets into Earth Day and recycling.
Speaking of Jane, I was also amused at the subtle dig at the then-current resurgent wave of feminism by making Miss Devonshire's first name Thelma Louise. You tend to put in a lot of little throwaway gags like that.
That was a tough one because I wanted a name that would get a really good laugh. And up until a day or two before we shot it, her name was Laverne Shirley Devonshire. And I remember thinking, it wasn't as funny. And something about her name just was Thelma Louise Devonshire. of having it announced at a wedding and like of nobody laughing out loud.
I even had a third one.
Yeah, I was really going to use Lucy Ethel Devonshire was the other one. I don't know. I just thought Thelma Louise seemed to get the best chuckle on set when I tested both lines, so we went with it.
So tell us about another supporting character who actually did appear in every one of the Vice Academy films, Mark Richardson. He was in one of the better, like, quote, heavy metal horror films, Shock 'Em Dead, with the aforementioned Tracy Lords, as well as Class of Nukem High Part 2, Subhumanoid Meltdown. But he'll always be the sleazy porn casting invasion from Vice Academy for me. That whole scene with him and Linnea going over her fake resume was priceless.
I was very proud of that, naming her character Dee Dee Fluffer, which I knew not everybody would pick up. Like today, I would name her character Dee Dee Bukkake or something. Just something very few people would get.
For those in the audience who don't know what a fluffer is.
I mean, I need a name. I love the way Miss Devonshire slips her that resume, just knowing the humiliation she's going to get. And one of her films, like Beat Me in St. Louis, If I Could Talk to the Animals.
But it says here. Now, by the time we get to part four, the question was, you know, tell us a little bit about Mark.
Mark holds the distinction of, there's several actors did five Vice Academies. He is the only one to appear in all six. Yeah, I mean, he was an art department guy, but he loved acting. And he was just really good, not really good at memorizing dialogue, but he just had that seediness down.
Yeah.
And there was always going to be, you know, I think even in six, which isn't my favorite of the series, he's still funny as, you know, the strip club owner and just coming up with names for him in each movie. But yeah, I did like him as the pimp in Vice Academy 4. He's Bojangles. That's five. Yeah, four, he's Slash, the one who, the cheapest band they can get to play at a wedding.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Rick Sloan. Coming up, we discuss Vice 4 to 6, Ginger's Jail Time, Liz Kaitan's weird later career, Hobgoblins, and Mystery Science Theater 3000's Kurdish. By the time we get to part four, none of the original leads are here anymore, as Ginger Lynn also took her leave. I understand it was because she was coming to you with some rather unrealistic demands. Wasn't this around the time she was involved with Charlie Sheen, who once famously remarked that she actually partied too hard for me?
Oh, he had another quote. They take digs at each other. He had another really good one. I don't know why. I'm not sure how recently he said this. He said, yeah, I remember Ginger Lynn. She used to turn heads. She still does, just the other direction.
Ouch.
Ginger was, I mean, we were good friends on the first one. We were friends on the second one. She was just so caught up between Charlie and parting too much. She was a nightmare on part three. I mean, 3.5 hours late, she never, I mean, every take, and I shot Mind, Body, and Soul at the same time, it was basically, you feed her the line before, she'll probably get her next line. You do the next line, and then you tell her what her next line is to say, and then you have to cut. Because she couldn't do more than two or three sentences. She would never memorize anything anymore.
Wow.
So she's slow. I mean, just the idea of slowing the day down, then she had to have her motor home through the movie over budget. And it was like, you know, everybody else was getting stuff on one and two takes, and Ginger was eight minimum.
Wow.
So, and she was actually bragging, I bet Rick will never hire me again. So, she got that one right. But she holds a distinction, actually, so does Karen Russell, of just not being asked back.
Wow.
I reunited with Ginger less than a year ago and to do a reunion interview for Mind, Body, and Soul. It was interesting that very first thing she said when she showed up is, so, Rick, why'd you stop hiring me?
Wow.
we made amends. I still make jokes about her, but
so Ginger actually wound up serving 4 years in federal prison for income tax evasion.
No, it wasn't that. She's probably she got off like 3 months or something.
But it was in relation to her porn earnings not long after this. And I know that in Vice Academy 3, Ginger spends much of the film behind bars. So I'm assuming this was the snarky commentary on the then pending real life event.
The movie was first. I didn't know what was going on later. It was kind of like a prophecy and karma, I guess. But, yeah, this I need a motorhome. I need this. I need this. You can't treat people this way. And like 2 weeks later, she's in jail. So that was a huge laugh among everybody.
I really thought, you know, the timing-wise, that you must have known. And
absolutely. But I mean, in the later sequels, I didn't make one joke about her in part four. But yeah, starting with five, we got a few digs at her. She's always back in jail complaining. And in part six, I mean, she actually calls on the police station on the intercom, like I have a message from Holly from like Tascadero Prison. I'm sick of this shit. and it was some line from one of my other movies where she forgot her line and started cussing, and I used it. And then I made that whole fake trailer out of outtakes of I Killed Him, I Liked Him, So What, which was an autobiography she was doing. I did it, I liked it, so what.
Wow.
So there's a lot of and at the very beginning of the trailer, a bad audit. So, and I remember, God, not Entertainment Tonight, Read Your Hollywood Story, Hard Copy or Access Hollywood. They contacted me during Ginger's lawsuit, and last time I ever let people use clips for free. I didn't realize you'd get money later, which I did. But, yeah, the footage of Ginger in prison from Vice 2, Vice 3, right. Mind, Body, and Soul, they certainly got their mileage out of it. I mean, they used it in, like, there's a 30-minute documentary, I think, at Access Hollywood or something about Ginger. And, yeah, I mean, whenever they talk about her career in porn, they'd show Vice Academy footage when she's in jail. They'd show, you know, it was like so much of the movie, you know, looked like it was shot specifically for the episode.
So one thing that was a bit off about parts 3 to 4 was how you kept the same recurring character, Malathion. I preferred the unique baddies in the other entries as opposed to the same person coming back over and over. But I will say that part 4 was priceless with the wedding of Miss Devonshire. I think this is actually my wife's favorite. The whole sequence with her bachelorette party where all the prison guards are playing History Date. It's so sad.
That's like the hardest prop to find. This is before eBay. Oh, my God, was that thing hard to find.
It's so sad and pathetic, and it's hilarious at the same time. My wife actually went looking around for a vintage copy of Mystery Date after that, just for the cheese factor.
There's like five different versions. They kept updating it, but yeah, I had to get it. Ms. Devonshire is stuck in 63, and she had to have the 64, 65, the original version.
It's like, oh, you got the dud. And the weapons were so crappy, they even had to use prisoners for guests.
Usually, what part of how I would write a Vice Academy is every time I come to a standstill on there, what's the worst thing that could happen next? Which became a running joke because Ms. Devonshire would keep saying it in the later films.
Right.
But the wedding to me, I mean, it's one of my personal dares to film school students. We shot that wedding in one day.
Wow.
It runs almost 20 minutes.
Yes.
It has 60 extras. I mean, I spent like 2 days blocking out every shot. I'd stagger the extras to show up because I knew they wouldn't be there all day, getting like all the stuff when I only had a few of them. But, I mean, that was amazing. And the car chase was shot afterward, but I love that one where they're just driving recklessly, changing their clothes, and they run into the wedding.
And in part five, you seem to be running out of steam a little. The whole conceit of the virtual reality.
I don't get it. I don't. Five, I think. I mean, Julia was the best of the villains, but I think five is the best script. I think it's the most clever of all of them. I love five. Four and five are like the only ones that I still watch.
You know, from my perspective, like the whole conceit of the virtual reality hooker that was coming into the real world, it seemed to be a grab from Hobgoblins with Fantasia.
Well, that was until the second one where she comes out of the computer. But I think it was the movie Weird Science is where it was taken from. But I just love the idea of this coming up with the most degrading computer game. Like, it's a hooker and you pick what she charges and how she dresses. And even if she gets offended, like, how much should I charge? And like, it's programmed to say, like, 50 or 100 or 200. It's like, $5?
Finally, you end the series with part 6. It's still a fun film, but the jokes aren't flying as Fast and Furious anymore, and the whole thing's starting to feel a bit tired. I mean, you got the same corridors, the same storeroom, the same characters, the same situation. You can almost feel the cast sighing a bit. You know, while I certainly appreciate getting two extra films out of you and the whole gang, you know, the glory days of parts 1 to 4 were kind of behind us by now.
It's funny because 4, everyone had fun. 5, everyone had fun. I don't know. 6 was just one of those things. No one really wanted to come back for one more film. And I was just thinking later down the road, 6 is a better box set than 5.
Right.
And ironically, everyone came back. I did not have to recast one actor. I mean, it's a clean sweep. But half the cast just told me, I'm only giving you 1 day or 2 days. So a lot of it was, everyone, I think, the timing of when it was shot, they had other jobs going on. So it was kind of like everyone was just sitting exhausted between shots. No, it didn't have the energy the other ones did.
Right.
It's just, everyone was, they agreed to do it, but I don't know. 6, I hated the actress who played the villain. I mean, she couldn't act.
Right.
The stripper. 6, I don't know. It definitely doesn't. Yeah. 5, I don't think we lost the steam on it. 6, I mean, we were past losing the steam. 6
yes.
was beating a dead horse, practically.
It really did feel like you were saying, like, they were just tired. It felt like the cast was just sighing, like, oh, boy, here we go again. And
because every movie, I would always, that same hallway, there's always a shot of the girls running down it, and I'd always say, this will be the last time you're going to have to run down it. And ironically, within a year, we'd be doing another sequel. On 6, I never even bothered to say it because we all knew.
So do you know what happened with Liz thereafter? Because I think Vice Academy 6 was her last film, or her next to last, before she dropped out to become an admin for some crazy right-wing pundit. What happened to her to lead her down that path?
Well, 6 was her last movie, but Liz got married. I mean, it's not that – Liz has always said she would do a cameo for me in a moment if I even had a part for her.
Right.
So I can get her back on screen. And Liz looks amazing. She's aged so well.
Right.
Well, much like, you know, Liz and I kind of both retired for a while at the same time, but
right.
the market had changed, and, you know, I mean, her job isn't, I don't know, it didn't change her life, but now she got married, she has a stepson, just kind of got out of the business. It was tough because the movies, like one of the, I had Action Pay-Per-View wanted Vice Academy 7, they wanted me to shoot a porno version of it, though, 3 versions, and just... The soft core, my phones aren't even soft, for the hard PG days of Married with Children, they had gone the way of just USA was sold and they weren't running them.
Right.
And everybody wanted harder core sex. I just didn't really want to do them. So I kind of, you know, considering 6, the series was already, you know, it was on ghost days of living beyond its means, you know.
Right.
It wasn't going to come back on life support.
Right. It was just surprising to see that she had gone that way because, you know, I really liked her in her film this, and she did not seem like the kind of person that would wind up doing something like that. It was, like, totally out of left
field. She got married is all it was. That's what it was.
So will there be any more Vice Academy films in the future, or is the series definitively over? Because it'd be great to have, like, a cast reunion, even if it's something like what you do with Hobgoblins, too, where they mock their lookalike replacements.
It's funny, Vice Academy 4 was going to be the cast reunion, but after the bullshit Ginger put me through in part 3, there's something like when you watch Happy Days, Joni and Chachi's wedding,
right.
every single character actor who was ever on the show came to the wedding.
Right.
And I wanted to get every single person back, like Queen Bee in shackles, with Spanish Fly cussing each other out, and, yeah, Ginger would probably still be in jail, like, pissed off, or Linnea, I don't know what. But I wanted everyone to be there. And it's just, you know, Ginger was a pain in the ass on 3. Linnea's agent thought she was too good for it. I just, you know, I didn't need to hear the demand for, like, a cameo shot from everybody.
Right.
So that would have been the one. And personally, I'd love to see Vice Academy, like, you know, much like Night of the Demons and 100 other movies, like, bought and remade with a bigger budget.
Right. So
I actually have my cast if it was ever made as a studio film.
So let's shift gears and address the much briefer but equally entertaining series of yours, Hobgoblins. While the films are ostensibly a low-budget take on Gremlins, once again, they occupy an entirely different universe because I didn't even like Gremlins, but I love Hobgoblins and more recently Hobgoblins 2.
You actually like 2? Wow.
Yeah, I did.
2 is a tough one. I mean, it was so hard trying to... I was not able to exactly match how I did the first one. I tried. You know, I shot on short ends and had no permits, but I don't know. It looks much more like Vice Academy 6. I couldn't recapture that guerrilla filmmaking of, you know, shooting car chases in public and stuff like that.
Right. So I understand the Hobgoblins was actually a big hit for you and was dubbed into numerous languages for overseas sale.
Hobgoblins, people laugh at it. It's one of the 25 worst films of all time. It was my first hit movie. It is the only film I've ever made. There was a bidding war on that movie.
Wow.
Transworld, Charlie Band, some other companies. I mean, the two of them daily would up each other's offer. I was offered so many movies as director. Charlie Band wanted me an exclusive deal after that. I don't know. And regardless of what people say, Hobgoblins was very successful. Overseas, yeah, it sold to like over 50 countries.
Wow.
So, yeah, not the film I'd like to be known for, but it surpassed Hobgoblins. I mean, people don't talk much about Vice Academy. I mean, Hobgoblins kind of overtook it.
I'm astonished that it was once listed as the second worst film ever made. I mean, I think that's beyond exaggeration. I don't really find any independent films to be anywhere near the level of badness as the average Hollywood production, particularly nowadays. At least you're getting at someone's unique and personal vision, some special failings in special effects or costumes or whatever. You can attribute that to budget limitations. Hollywood has like zero excuses for the crap that you routinely churns out. You know, I really can't watch it for the most part, but give me a film by, you know, Rick Sloan, Mark Polonia, Bill Z. Bub, and I can find something entertaining and worthwhile on there. You know, I'll watch those sort of films over and over, and it doesn't cost $12 a ticket per person, minus concessions.
I don't know. To me, a good bad movie is one. I mean, it's funny for the wrong reasons, but a real bad movie is you'll turn it off in 5 or 10 minutes.
Exactly.
It's more like a train wreck of just watching it. I mean, Hobgoblins, no matter what you think of it, I don't know anyone who saw it and never watched it again.
Exactly. You got to bring your friends over. You got to check this movie out. You know, it's fun. And that's what I find in a lot of these movies. You know, even if you are saying, wow, this is really cheesy and you laugh at it, it's, you know, it's a good thing. It's like a camp thing because you're appreciating it at the same time. Whereas, you know, I go in a lot of Hollywood movies and I'm like, why do I waste my time and money? You know, you're getting
nothing. I've been so tempted the last couple of years about testing would Hobgoblins work as a midnight movie.
You should try it.
You know, people dressing as the characters and doing the right fight instead of the time warp in front of the audience. I just think it would really lend. I don't know. It has a following. I think it would be hysterical to see it.
If they ever did it by me, I would go.
I never pulled a film print of that one. Because Visitants, which I made less than a year before Hobgoblins, is like my favorite movie. That's the one. Mystery Science Theater, everyone seems to know that I submitted the film, but they asked me to. USA owned Sci-Fi Channel, and they acquired Mystery Science Theater. My contract was they could run all my films on their show, and they gave them all the Vice Academies, and I'm not sure exactly who I spoke with. Someone at Best Brains called me up. They said, do you have any other movies that aren't so sexual? They were just saying like more like the sci-fi genre, so I wanted them to run Visitants. That's the one I gave them, and I guess it's too obviously intentionally campy. But so people don't get that Hobgoblins is intentionally campy. They think it was meant to be serious. Like, no. I gave them Blood Theater. They didn't like it. I hesitated. I still have the letter when I gave them Mind, Body, and Soul, and they rejected it. But I would have been surprised they took it. And I was holding out because I really didn't want to give them. And they said, do you have anything else? And I'm thinking, I know you're going to want this one. And yeah, they grabbed Hobgoblins. It was never one of my favorite movies. And, you know, Visitants is the one, you know, I wanted a midnight movie. I made it like Rocky Horror for everyone to dress up. And it never got the cult audience. Or Hobgoblins, I didn't really try, is the one that has it.
Right. So since you
I would be proud. I mean, God, I would love to test market that somewhere.
Since you jumped ahead to Mystery Science, how did you take being parodied on the show? Because some directors and actors love it, and they appreciate the humor and the increased audience interest in the films this generates. But you get a few like Joe Don Baker who essentially threatened to beat the hell out of the show's staff if he ever encountered any of them.
With the exception of that interview they did with a mannequin of me over the end credits, I was mortified. I mean, they said my name like every 10 seconds. I guess that's how people know who I am. But I thought it was hysterical. I mean, I loved their version of the movie. It's just the first job I ever had is I worked at 20th Century Fox briefly promoting Rocky Horror, doing these conventions when I was like 18 and 19, but there is something so cool about just graduating high school and having a studio drive on past. So it had a heavy influence on why I wanted to make movies. It's just so magical. And I had a very, I mean, because they cultivated that whole audience of the whole cult thing of, you know, the things people throw and the costuming. It was very structured. I mean, it kind of fans did it. But it would have never spread nationwide without, you know, a lot of insight from Fox of how to do it.
Right.
So I knew kind of what went into a cult movie, which it was kind of just over-the-top campy. It lent itself to multiple viewings. The characters were dressed like it's Halloween, so people would dress as them, not come in regular clothes. And I just really tried. I mean, I was trying for that movie. And ironically, Hobgoblins is the movie you can shout back at. I mean, I wound up making one.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of Mystery Science again, they really laid into you. Like you mentioned, that the cardboard cutout. I think this may have been the only time they actually called out the director personally. So.
I was shocked. I know they consider Hobgoblins one of the worst films they've ever done. But it's just because my movies always have heavy sexual innuendo. They had to clip. The movie would have got a PG. There's no sex, no nudity, no bad language. They took 7 minutes out of that movie of just offensive jokes. And I remember watching, like, there's a whole second sequence where Kyle calls Fantasia and to get phone sex, and she's there. I'm going to see a movie. It's only rated PG. I want you to show up and make it rated X. When the movie starts, sneak in the rear door, drop your pants and show me a full moon, roll my naked body on those sticky floors and lick that artificial butter flavor off my butt. Oh, they clip that whole scene. And there's so much Daphne material. Like, we're supposed to be looking for Amy. Why don't you try looking under the table? Daphne's an expert at being under the tables here. What color are the rugs? Daph. Same color as the carpet. Birds on my knees, Nick. Oh, that came out. Oh, the whole part of, like, oh, a road rash is there. Like, my bike's right outside. He's trying to get Amy to go with him. And Kevin's there, like, Amy doesn't like motorcycles. She's terrified of them. And he looks to her like she's an imposter. And she goes, sitting on a motorcycle is like riding the world's largest vibrator. No, did that one come up? But, yeah, they were just, they're not used to sci-fi movies with so much raunchy humor in it.
Right.
But, I mean, it amazed me, you know, how much they had. They really excised a lot out of that movie.
Listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Rick Sloan. Coming up, we discuss the Hobgoblin puppets being operated by a woman from a mental home, the gardens of the fight, Hobgoblin School and Script of 3, Bikini Academy, a.k.a. Babe Watch. And that's Third Eye Cinema. Stated at one point that the puppets in the film were actually operated by a woman who was just released from a mental hospital,
yeah.
And that's why they moved so poorly.
It's hard to blame her. They couldn't do much better. It was the whole thing of the puppets weren't delivered until the night before we were shooting, and I had never done a puppet movie. I didn't. Yeah, they looked good in still photos. They just couldn't do much. But yeah, because if you look, in part two, the puppets are much better operated. But that whole idea of there's always, like, imagine, like, a hand just shaking back and forth, like, with palsy. That's a lot of in part one. And then half the time they were always facing the wrong way. But, yeah, she was people thought she was a homeless woman. They didn't realize she was part of the crew. But it was the girl who was assistant director on Blood Theater. She had been hit by a car, went into a mental hospital. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to blame her, but It is a good story, and it's a true story of, yeah, the puppets were operated by a woman who had just gotten out of the mental hospital.
So I understand.
It's true.
So I understand that the infamous garden tool fight between Nick the Army guy and Kevin the ostensible hero of the film was actually imposed on you by the distributor, as was the character of Nick in the first place.
They didn't ask for a garden tool fight, but they wanted an Army character because it would make it more of an action film. This was still, my films were still, it was, International was where the money was.
Right.
It wasn't until Vice Academy hit USA Network the following year that domestically I remolded on the audience I was aiming for. And they wanted more like a scene at him at the Army base with combat and some fight scenes. And I had no budget, and there's no place in the script for it. So, yeah, he just got released from the Army. And there's a great one in part two where he was dishonorably discharged because he screams like a woman. I always thought that the guy who played Nick in the second one was funny. But, yeah, they just wanted some combat fight scene, and I couldn't figure out where to put it, and I just figured, I don't know, how about just the damn garden tools? And it was a 30-second scene, but they wanted me to make it longer, and I had to use every frame we shot, where Kevin's knocked down 3 or 4 times, or he's only knocked down once in the real cut.
Right.
That was their tampering. So basically, that was theirs. I would have never put that scene in the movie. And the puppets looking that cheap, we had no budget. So the minute I saw the puppets through the camera, I knew we were in trouble. So those are the two unintentional things. But all the dialogue and exactly the delivery the actors use is exactly how I told them to say it. That, I mean, it's not like I was trying to make a good, serious puppet movie, and this kept trying to act. That's exactly the movie I was trying to make, except for those two scenes.
One thing that really stands out about Hobgoblins is that the film really didn't have a plot. I mean, you have old MacReady, who's been working the same crappy night watchman job at the old film studio for decades just to keep an eye on the creatures in the wall. One of his young assistants lets him out, and they wreak some very limited-scale havoc. I mean, I think my favorite scene is when they're driving his golf cart around the parking lot. But the rest of the film, they're just harassing Kevin and his friends, fulfilling their fantasies, only trying to kill him in the end. It's very limited in scope. You'd think
there's
they'd be all over
puppets. How much havoc can they create?
Like, you know,
I mean, it's not like Gremlins. There's like 200 of them.
You'd think they'd be all over the city attacking people at random, but no, they just head to Kevin's house and mess with his friends. I mean, it's like it's part of the joke.
I had to shoot that movie. They weren't going. No, I mean, yeah, believe me. I don't know. They still go to some fun locations along the way, but
oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know how close Kevin lives to where he works, but, I mean, he certainly didn't need a car to get there because those puppets sure found the house.
It's part of the joke, and it speaks to the basic absurdity of the film that, you know, it's so small scale.
People just don't grasp how little money these films were shot with. Like, film stock, which is really expensive. I've shot Wastelands, which are only a minute long that labs would throw away. Hobgoblins was shot on, I got the stuff for 2 or 3 cents a foot, a film that was past its expiration date that normally nobody would shoot it. So the night scenes, they're very muddy in places. No, I mean there's just, I mean, no permits. I mean, Hobgoblins got in the can for $15,000. That was 35 millimeter.
Wow. So, another favorite part of the film was to visit the club Scum. So why were roughneck biker types frequenting a club with a very Joel Grey and cabaret-style host? He was very Gary Newman-esque.
I just like the name Club Scum. It was some joke from Blood Theater. I was just trying to come up with the seediest club. It really wasn't until the second Vice Academy, or the Vice-O-Rama. But I had real trouble thinking what would go on at Club Scum. Unfortunately, I shouldn't have. The club was so large, and we didn't have any extras, which didn't help. Which I learned from that mistake that in the Vice Academy graduation scene, we moved 20 park benches, so it didn't look like where's all the extras. But, yeah, the club's a little big. I just had trouble grasping what would go on. I mean, I wanted a band to play there, the One Hit Wonder group. I don't know. I couldn't decide what kind of acts they would have there. It was just weird. So it was just kind of a free-for-all. They have strippers and, you know, some Pee Wee Herman guy hosting it, and you know, some guy who would later work in a pawn shop in a Tarantino movie, working the door, and a girl with a huge beehive dancing and hooking. It was just a mismatch. It was more of a John Waters thing of just how many weird things could I throw into it.
Exactly, so absurd. So Hobgoblins 2, I know you put it into production based on renewed interest in the original film due to Mystery Science Theater and that IMDb rating, but I understand you actually had a script written for this back in 1988, which was dropped in light of USA picking up the Vice Academy films as an ongoing series?
Was it dropped? It was, yeah, Hobgoblins was made in 87, Vice Academy was 88, they both were released in 88. And I did March for Murder the following year, and Hobgoblins, I mean, oh, it was making so much money overseas that I don't think there was any Gremlin ripoff film that didn't have two or three or four sequels.
Right.
They all did. There was, like, I don't know how many Trolls or Ghoulies.
Right.
Or Munchies. But none of them had just one. And, yeah, I mean, I planned a Hobgoblins 2. The second USA Network bought Vice Academy, and it got the highest ratings, I just kind of did Vice Academy 2 instead. And I figured I could still go back to Hobgoblins, and then there was Vice Academy 3. So, yeah, it was just a film that never was real. 3, actually, if 2 wasn't, 2 was heavily pirated on the internet within a day of its release.
Oof.
And I didn't realize a lot of the original cast would return, because the first couple that I contacted were difficult, so that's why there's no cameos in 2. But 3, which I doubt will ever get made, but it is 25 years after the first one. Everyone is aged. It's the original cast. It's MacReady's funeral. They all reunite, and let's see, Kevin and Amy are married, but the spark is long gone from their relationship. Oh, Fantasia's been arrested for ripping men off of all their money, and Kyle's the dumbest one. She calls and he posts her bail and lets her move in with him. Nick and Daphne have recently separated because a Vietnamese hooker came to the door with a photo that Nick was her father. It showed a picture with her mom, and Daphne throws him out of the house. But they haven't seen each other in like 10 or 15, 20 years. And at the funeral, oh, besides Daphne going, "Hey, Nick, look at this," while he's being a pallbearer and drops the casket, MacReady rolls on the street. he has his video will, and he gives one last warning. Cause it's always a little different of, you've never fully escaped the Hobgoblins. Never make a wish and call to them to make it happen. He just warns them for the last time that all these things happen where, see, Nick gets drafted into something really dangerous. No, he's going to be sent overseas, some fictional, obviously parodied war country where he would die, because
right.
That's his dream in combat. And Daphne realizes that, you know, she shouldn't have wished that to happen to him. Amy winds up having an affair and is riddled with guilt that she slept with someone else. Kyle's having his dream date with Fantasia. She drugs his wine, and he wakes up tied to the bed, and she's on the internet. She's going to sell his kidneys. And it just keeps going back and forth of the three scenes of, why did this happen? Oh, God, is there any way I could undo it? And all of them at once say, "Hobgoblins, Hobgoblins, Hobgoblins," and the puppets are back. Oh, and Kevin made the biggest mistake wish of all. He goes, "Mr. MacReady, I really wish you hadn't died." So he brings him back from the grave. And so there's MacReady. This would have been my favorite line. It's like, "Kevin, you must destroy the Hobgoblins. I can't go on like this. I can't get a job as a senior greeter at Kmart. Walmart won't serve me. I need to rest in peace." So I was going to send them to, like, the original Hobgoblins crash site, which probably would have been Bronson Canyon, where the spaceship first crashed, that there's some cave they're still living in, just to undo all these horrible things that they made and send MacReady back to the grave. So 3 actually would have been a really good one. But I don't know. 2 years from now, I mean, we'll see.
Okay. It was actually rather amusing, like a fan homage to a beloved trash classic, complete with some scene-for-scene recreations, but with this odd twist that this was actually done by the original director. And the closest thing I could think of would be Sam Raimi doing Evil Dead 2, which, in my opinion, just didn't work by comparison to the original. Hobgoblins 2, I thought it was pretty damn funny, and I actually enjoyed this one. And the extra you did with the original cast making fun of the lookalike actor.
That's my favorite.
That was great.
It was funny that they actually were somewhat, I don't know, I think they were kind of, I don't want to use the word jealous, they were kind of, it was like holy, like sacred territory, like, how dare you cast someone to play that role?
So,
but what was the close of the, well, I compare it more to like Herschel Gordon Lewis doing Blood Feast 2 of just, you know, many, many years later, revisiting some film that has some following. Evil Dead 2 was like, the number of years, he's remaking it now, but Evil Dead 2 and Evil Dead 1 were like, what, 2 years apart?
Something yeah, they're really close. How well did Hobgoblins 2 actually do in DVD sales? Can we expect to see Hobgoblins 3, or like you said, it's never going to get made?
No, the internet piracy killed it. I mean, 24 hours after it came out on DVD, it was pirated onto 35 websites for free viewing, and it took a huge hit. So, yeah, it's just, if it wasn't for that, I don't know. The only reason I did Hobgoblins, is much like Vice Academy 6, one extra sequel, Mystery Science Theater was coming back on the air, and they contacted me for their premiere episode. They actually wanted a Hobgoblins 2.
Wow.
And before the movie was completed, there was all these legal problems of who owned the title, who owned these characters. And they were that's why they all split into different groups, like Cinematic Titanic and Riff Trax. So the show never materialized. But, yeah, I shot the film specifically for that. It would have been such an honor to be their debut episode. But
right.
I don't know. A lot of fans, to me, it was just a novelty of trying to follow the original script and shoot it the way I would have. It has its moments, but, yeah, it's just bad for different reasons.
Well, for my part, I enjoyed it.
But the puppets look a lot better, don't they?
Yes, they do. They actually move a little bit. Do you have a favorite character in the Vice Academy or Hobgoblins films? And the puppet doesn't count.
Vice Academy would always be Miss Devonshire, but of the girls, Raylan, even though she only appears in the last two, there's just something about her, just the way she just stands there, like shaking her hips and chewing gum or twirling her. There's something just funny about her the whole time. I always thought she was funnier. I always loved her character. Hobgoblins, I don't know, Daphne was my favorite character.
I think it shows. He's come across. You've also done...
Fantasia is almost tied, kind of. Actually, a tie between those two.
You'd also done a few other films. I recall Babe Watch, The Forbidden Parody being very much along the same lines as the Vice Academy pictures, particularly the later ones. And you even had Raylan Salmon from Vice Academy 5 and 6 in it.
I was actually shot the other direction. Well, it was Bikini Academy was its title. USA Network renamed it Babe Watch. But, yeah, that was the first film I worked with her. And Vice Academy 5. Yeah, a lot of people think it was the other order. But, yeah, after I used her in that, I knew she'd be perfect to replace Ginger.
I was disappointed to see that.
By the time I did the Bikini Academy movie, I was looking for a new franchise. That was, for me, going to replace Vice Academy.
Right.
Of a really similar movie, though I hate filming at the beach, and it's probably a good thing. Yeah, I was just looking for another franchise title.
But I was disappointed to see it was released without one of your commentaries. It didn't really seem to be a take on either Baywatch or Lombada the Forbidden Dance. So
it'll be released properly. The first release, they didn't even check the quality control, and I mean, you can't even hear the actors talking, but... Yeah, I'm going back right now, and I've shot the Hobgoblins cast reunion. I thought was so cool.
Yeah,
I already shot one for Visitants. I got Mary Theater to do one for Blood Theater. Mary Warnoff. Most of the girls in Bikini Academy, only two live in L.A., but I found all four leads.
Wow. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Rick Sloan. Coming up, we discussed How She Went to Hell with Wynn Houser, The Visitants, The Girl's Stone, why his favorite. Now you're actually re-editing and releasing the DVD for the first time. A film I remember renting back in the VHS days is Mind, Body, and Soul, but which you retitled as House on the Edge of Hell with Ginger Lynn and Wings Houser, of all people. Now, I always get a kick out of Wings. It's a bit of a B-movie staple throughout the mid-80s and 90s. And
yeah,
I think this is actually... Yeah, it was actually his second film for you. So tell us a little bit about that.
Liv is very intimidating to work with. Yeah, I used him in Marked for Murder, which, again, Lionsgate currently has it, and you can watch it on, you can watch it on with commercials online, but they don't really have any plans to put it on DVD. In terms of financially, it made the most money of any film I made. It played theatrically overseas, grossed over $1 million. I mean, it was a very successful movie. But it was odd that I didn't enjoy doing it. It was my first drama where I call it directing with handcuffs on because, you know, every scene that I would have played for laughs, I had to, you know, do differently. I had much more fun on comedies, and it was a huge hit. But no, and, you know, I was thinking, what's next? And, you know, then those sequels came beckoning. So, Wings came back for the second one. He did not get along with Ginger either. You can never tell in the film. I mean,
right. So what's behind the re-edited version you're working on, and when can we expect to see it in release? Because you had mentioned it was actually banned in 14 countries.
It's my only film to be banned in 14 countries for graphic violence. So I actually went back and I put back in the footage that had to be taken out. And I decided, because someone else edited the film, I recut it. So that's going to be this year's DVD release. It's going to be retitled House on the Edge of Hell. And for all the publicity that's going to be on the trailer and on the poster where it says banned in 14 countries, it is completely true. It is. You can go to like Britain's film censor board and type in the movie. It was rejected by the censors 3 times. They finally had to take 3 minutes out, and they still gave it an 18, which is an X rating.
Wow.
Germany, which lets everything slide through, they took 3 minutes out. So it's just a version of the film that technically it was – the film is so heavily edited, it's never really been seen in this form. And it became almost a restoration work. I had to go back and I redid the mix and everything. But I have hopes for this one, and I always have a pile of scripts I want to work on next. It's just it's so hard to keep in touch with what's current, what sells right now. Because stuff comes and goes so quickly today. It doesn't have like the 5-year time span of the 80s where you could rip off Gremlins like 5 years later. Today it's like 4 months later or it's too late. No, House on the Edge of Hell, the new version in particular, because I just let someone else edit the first time, and they did a terrible job.
Right.
It's a much more frightening film, but in terms of why it was banned, looking at it today, I don't think most people are going to get it. Compared to Saw or Hostel, it's not that graphic.
Right.
But in its heyday, I mean, for people who collect the video nasty movies, it was a few years too late to get the title Video Nasty, but it's technically on that list.
Right.
And a lot of people like Last House on the Left, you know, Last House on Dead End Street. Yeah, I wanted a similar title. I thought it'd be kind of cool.
You've also mentioned that you're proudest of 2 films that usually don't get mentioned, the sci-fi flick Dissonance and Good Girls Don't. So what is it about these two that you feel puts your best foot forward, as it were? I know you were excited about getting both the Warhol Factory regular Mary Warrenoff and Christopher Knight from the Brady Bunch in the cast for Good Girls Don't.
They're just my 2 best films. I mean, much like when I used to have a director's reel, I never put Hobgoblins or Mind-Blowing Soul on the reel. They just weren't the films I wanted to be known for. Visitance was my 2nd movie. It was the last movie I made before I became technically a commercial director, where, I mean, it was the last film I had creative freedom. I didn't have distributors. You know, within a year or two, my films, you know, they weren't even written. They were being signed. Like, Vice Academy 2, I didn't even have a script. All I had to do was get the 2 lead actresses to agree to come back. And I was able to pre-sign domestic television, domestic video, and international just on the title.
Wow.
As long as it looked like the first movie. You know, they didn't even care what the story was.
You know, some people would die for that, but on the other hand, I understand that you're kind of creatively strapped at that point. Because you've got to...
I wasn't creatively strapped. I mean, out of every film I've made, if I could choose which one would have been the series, it would have been Vice Academy. But yeah, Visitance, I'm a huge Archie comic collector, and it was like my homage to Archie comics. And it's the movies, I call it my Plan 9 from Outer Space meets Rocky Horror, and with the Archie characters as the leads. It's a major send-up of those 50s Alien Invader movies. It's a period film in the 50s. Got in the can for $8,500, my lowest budget ever. It's, I don't know, it's kind of like Hobgoblins, but a much better movie. And 2 years ago, we had a 25th anniversary screening at a local theater, and it was just great to see the movie on a big screen again. It was just, I don't know, it's such a good movie. I mean, it's not something I'm embarrassed of. Good Girls Don't, because I spent more money and I took more time on it. I was trying to move up into, like, the next budget of films. Again, it never really, it got really good ratings in USA Network. They didn't like the movie when they saw it. It got the same ratings as Vice Academy, though. It's my slickest movie. I mean, it doesn't have those cheesy locations in the Vice Academy. Literally, what I paid for the locations in Good Girls Don't, I have shot entire features for. I think Hobgoblin was shot for what all the locations just cost. So it looks the most like a real film. I'm very proud of that movie. You know, those are my two favorite movies. No, Vice Academy 5 is probably my favorite film to watch. But I'd say Good Girls Don't is my best movie, and Visitants is my personal favorite.
So I gather it was never released on DVD, because I'd love to see it just based on the trailer.
It will be. Yeah, it was signed by two companies. Just, you know, some place that signed it and never paid me, so I was tied up for a few years. Yeah, it's not going to need the heavy restoration work. But yeah, I already got the cast. These DVD bonuses, I spent a lot of time in editing because, I don't know,
right.
I was trained by an Academy Award-winning sound editor. So my stuff's just a lot more elaborate. It takes forever.
Right.
Redoing the Devil movie, oh my God, the amount of time. I mean, the trailer's online. Just that one-minute trailer took 100 hours.
Wow.
No, I mean, there's subliminal cuts, 2 and 3 frames. There's 70 sound effect tracks. There's like 9 picture tracks simultaneously to get all the film damage effects. I mean, I love the way it looks, but oh my God, it's labor intensive.
So from what you're saying, not only are we going to get this House on the Edge of Hell re-edit, but we're probably going to get Visitants and Bikini Academy re-released properly. So are there any other projects in the work which you'd like to address?
Well, in terms of reissues, I'm thinking probably of double disc sets. I was thinking of Good Girls Don't, Bikini Academy as a double disc set, and Blood, Theater, and Visitants as a double disc set.
Oh, great.
And I have like 5 scripts right now. I keep juggling back and forth of, you know, I don't need another one where I miss the target of what's popular and it keeps changing.
Right.
I have my own Mean Girls ripoff. What was it called? Oh, Raving Beauties. I love bitchy girl movies.
Yeah, I can tell.
I have one. It's Mean Girls meets Reanimator, where the new smart girl who gets transferred to their class, they can't stand her. And they invite her to a party where they're going to drug her, drink, and let all the football team get, you know, date rape her, and then videotape it and post it online. But she sees something's dropped in her drink, and she switches it. And while they're there, the football players decide, you know, the other girl, they always do this too. Why don't we do it to her also? And then she sees that and switches the drink, and the same guy drinks both of them and dies. And because they have a video of her, like, you know, they blackmail her because she's so smart. She was able to, with adrenaline and electricity, to bring a frog slightly back to life.
Right.
So they forced her to do it to the guy, and between car batteries, and, you know, they were able to do it, but he's been brain dead for like half an hour, so he's just much stupider. But as the story progresses, he's still going to school, but he's physically dead, and he starts smelling. But it's just like Mean Girls. I mean, the stuff those girls say to each other.
Right.
That's one. My personal favorite, I love urban legend movies. I have like a Bloody Mary Candyman type movie. I love to use Mary Warren. It's about this Sunday school teacher from 40 years ago who she abuses and beats all the children and threatens them never to tell their parents. And the local movie theater changes ownership from family films to porno. She puts a bomb there to get rid of it. And she goes back the next day to watch it go off, and all the parishioners from her church, oh, we have such good news. We spoke to the owners. They're going to move to a new location, and the bomb goes off. So all the kids are orphaned. All their parents are dead, but they never find Mary Warnoff's character.
Right.
And like Bloody Mary, there's this curse that you can call to her, and she's invoked again like 30 years later, and she starts killing off kids again.
Right.
That one, God, I wanted to do a scary movie type parody, but those things have been beaten to death already. It's the one I'm missing. I know that. Yeah, I have a pile of them.
Do we have any time frame on these DVDs? Do you have any clue when you're going to try to get them out? Or
it's hard to say because the market keeps changing. It's at a point I don't think they're going to take stuff unless it's HD already.
Right.
Because I shot everything on film. I can go back and remaster them. But, I mean, especially like on the new edit of Mindbody and Soul, it's going to be so much work to read. So it's just I just need to get my foot in the door to another company. I had a bad falling out with Shout Factory after the movie was pirated online. I was encouraging them just to get the film on video on demand sooner, but who's going to pay to watch it when you can see it for free? I mean, literally yesterday I just took down on YouTube the complete version of Mystery Science Theater's Hobgoblins.
Right.
In one piece, the whole movie.
Wow.
And, every week I have to go online and try to get stuff removed. There's one site called freemedia.com. It has, like, 100 links to different films I've done.
Wow.
So it's an uphill battle.
One last question. It's a very important one. Betty or Veronica?
That's that same Ginger and Marianne. To me, it was much more about, Betty and Veronica were the role models for a lot of the women in my films. I just made them a lot trampier. No, seriously, the two girls in Vice Academy. I mean, Veronica, you know, the one who came from money, is Ginger's character. I was much fonder of just their feuding. It wasn't about, because I'm an Archie historian. According to John Goldwater, one of the original creators of Archie comics, it's not even a question. He says Archie would marry Betty from the beginning. I'd probably say Veronica because she's cattier and meaner and her joke. One of my personal favorite stories is, I've borrowed from, it's from around 68, 69, 70, where Betty wants a dress to go to a dance with Archie, and because she doesn't have the money, she opens a lemonade stand. Veronica's laughing at her, and all of a sudden all these people are buying lemonade. She's going to get enough money to buy her dress. So Veronica has all the servants come out and set up a lemonade stand to compete with her across the street. So then Betty goes inside and comes back, and she's baking free donuts and giving them out with the lemonade. And this is where it crosses into Vice Academy territory. Veronica goes back in the house, comes out in a micro mini dress, puts up a little like podium, cranks her radio on full blast, and she's go-go dancing in the middle of the street. And the cop shows up, and she gets a citation. But it's just stuff like that. It's much more like in Josie and the Pussycats. Alexandra is always my favorite character. Just the troublemaking bitch is the funny one for me.
So since you are a big Archie fan, what do you think of Return to Riverdale, the live-action TV movie from the early 90s with Lauren Holly?
Archie has never translated well into live action. I'm not sure why. I've seen, that's like the third or fourth one they've done. They've had the movie Betty and Veronica in and out of production for 20 years. And I actually spoke with, I don't want to name him, some Archie comics, but if the film's not really going to be made, it's just good publicity.
Right.
20 years ago, it actually was announced. It was Shannon Daugherty and Jenny Garth and Betty and Veronica.
Wow.
And today, it gets really huge publicity, but this is the proposed cast, but the film is not in production. Justin Bieber is Archie, which technically is not a bad choice. Miley Cyrus is Betty. Selena Gomez is Veronica. And I think the best one of the four so far is Taylor Lautner's Reggie. They didn't have a jacket yet. It's not really in production, but Archie's big right now. I mean, it had a resurgence. I've been writing for the Overstreet Comic Price Guy since I was 14 and pricing Archie. So Archie used to be the bottom rung. It was laughed at. And last year, Archie number one broke all records, and it's now the ninth most valuable comic book.
Wow.
I mean, people would laugh at Archie. That way it would never be a Superman or Spider-Man.
Right.
It's up there.
Well, with that, Rick, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and would love to have you back on to discuss upcoming projects in the future.
One more thing I want to tell people to check out when they get a chance.
Go for it.
You can. It's one of those things, so few people have heard of these because they were only big for a year. Do you know what Scopatones were, these early music videos?
Yes.
I would say Scopatones. I'm probably, when I do the reissue of my Bikini Movie, I'm going to use a clip from them in the documentary. But that cheesy, porno, garish look they have, I don't know how they got it that each one looks like a stripper movie. I don't know. They were the heaviest visual influence for the look of my films.
Wow.
And I was encouraged, because no one's ever seen them, just to go on YouTube. They're hysterically campy. But, yeah, just I'm always telling people, look at those. If you want to know why my films have that look, that's where I got it. Well, thank you. That was a fun interview.
Yeah, and, you know, just thinking about this, since I actually have 90 seconds left. How did you wind up becoming an Archie historian? Is it just because you collect so many?
Well, I've always been obsessed with Archie. Actually, I just bought some Archie item on eBay this past week. Started collecting Archie at 7. By 10, I discovered the used bookstores. I love the older ones. All the period looks in my movies are from Archie comics. I knew by the time I was 13, I knew what the 40s, 50s, and 60s looked like. The clothes, the cars, just how everything was supposed to be. I don't know, when they started doing Archie books, I was always the one. I had a complete collection by the time I was 19, so I was the one they would come to. They did Archie, the Celebration of a Generation, last year, and there's a whole centerfold spread of just all my stuff in there.
Wow.
So, I don't know, I'm a huge Archie fan, and cool. I don't know, when you have a complete set and people write books, sometimes they need your stuff for their
but
legal thing.
So, once again, I'd like to thank you for coming on, and it was definitely fun talking to you after all these years.
Thanks.
All right, take it easy, Rick. Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our up-close and personal interview with Rick Sloan. Next week on week 32 of Third Eye Cinema, Tony Paparo of New Jersey thrash speed metal veterans Whiplash. If you'd like to join us here, contact us, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician you'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience.